The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision?
Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI.
Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow.
Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you, you are here. That makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. Coming to you live from various places, emphasis on live, which will be important later in the show. One of the most amazing things about our imperfect country, the United States, is no fooling, it's national parks. It's a huge, huge country, and a lot of it is dedicated to wildlife. And I think we've all had that experience when you talk to someone who's not from the U.S. and they're like, hey, we're going to land in New York. What are you doing this weekend? Oh, we thought we'd drive over to Chicago.
Right. Yeah. There's so many amazing national parks in the like western side of the contiguous United States. Mm-hmm. I've not done extensive traveling over there, but man, it makes me want to just exist on that side of the country for a while, yeah, just to see the parks.
Well, I'll tell you who has done that to a great degree is a friend of the show, Alex Williams, who has posted up in many a national park in that and other parts of the country. He is a bit of an outdoorsman.
I love it. I love it. And a huge fan of maps as well. Check out his show, Ephemeral, which in my mind proves what podcast can be and can do. You also, spoiler, might hear some familiar voices in those episodes. Now, we have been fortunate to explore some, but by no means all, of the U.S. national parks in person, and they are absolutely worth it. The U.S. is vast. To a degree, it's still filled with wild country, and it's home to so much amazing flora and fauna. Yet, depending upon whom you ask, these national parks may also be home to something else. Ghost. Let's begin the tour. Here are the facts. We won't spend too much time on this, but it's important to know the history of national parks.
That's right. The story of the national parks system officially begins back in March of 1871 when Congress created the Yellowstone National Park in the what was then territories of Montana and Wyoming under the control of the Secretary of the Interior. Which I've always found to be a bit of a perplexing concept. The interior of what? Like everything within the United States? I don't know. It's a weird one. But what are you going to do? And this was as a benefit for the public. The idea of, you know, having green spaces where people can hang out and maintaining them.
Yeah. So gone are the days of, you know, the European royal reserves, right? Like back in Europe under various monarchies, the king or the crown would have their own hunting lands and peasants could be executed for venturing onto these grounds. So it's a big step to say, hey, we were keeping this green space for everyone.
Well, except for the indigenous peoples that lived on the land prior to that, right? And even some homeowners that, you know, people who had moved west especially and kind of staked their own land. And then somebody came through and said, actually, this is part of our thing now, so you've got to go.
You guys, I was about to say, I recently kind of started thinking about the idea of how much we take for granted the idea of land, you know, like owning land. Who does the land belong to? Luckily, I guess, through a lot of convoluted legal practices and documents and things like that, we've more or less sorted that out. People can't just come and, you know, plant a flag in your yard. But there was a time where that would come and you would pay the blood price.
And litigation continues today with various Native American communities who are regaining control of land that was repeatedly stolen from them. This is simply an historical fact. And I think it's also very American for there to be these beautiful ideas in writing and concept with ugly real world practices behind them. I mean, what happened, as imperfect and at times evil as it was, is that the creation of Yellowstone led to a global movement to create, maintain, and if needed, protect national parks. And that protection clause becomes ever more important as industry starts coming in and saying things like, hey, we'll sponsor this park and all we want in exchange is the mineral rights. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, or a little chunk of, we want to have access to a little chunk of land to do our thing, and you can I'll keep the rest. We don't want that. We just need this one area because there's lots of copper over here.
And we'd also,
don't mind us.
Yeah, we'd also like a right to renegotiate this based on what we find, you know, every 2 to 5 years.
Well, we still see stuff. We talked about it pretty recently with when huge car manufacturers are trying to expand or something, and that practice of just deciding, well, actually, we kind of need we need the stuff that you're occupying right now, like that whole thing. We need that. So we're going to use the laws to take it.
Our domain is imminent. Yeah.
Yeah. And Ben, I don't think this, I really like where you're going here with the positive side of national parks, because I think for me personally, national parks are on the whole a majorly positive thing. I think you're right to say that there's like this side to it, right? That like everything is a little darker than we'd like to think about.
Well, look at what we've got. Look at all this natural splendor, you know, that exists under our purview. But let's not talk about the ugly way we got it.
Right, right. People stumble into places like Yellowstone or the Grand Canyon or glaciers, and they say, this is amazing. And then millennia-old cultures say, yeah, we know, we live here.
We were there. So we were there, dude.
We're there the whole time. One more step in history we owe to President Theodore Roosevelt, most famous, of course, for inspiring the stuffed teddy bear. He's like the famous amateur wrestler Abraham Lincoln. He creates the national parks movement, the big one, because he's inspired by a naturalist and very eccentric inventor named John Muir.
Wasn't Roosevelt also like a big game hunter? He liked to kill stuff. Yeah,
conservationist meant a different thing back then.
I guess it did. Yeah, sort of like Darwin eating every example of a species that he discovered.
Yep, just so. True story. And shout out to our pal Jack O'Brien, who hit us to that one a while back. So Muir stood tall against the dominant sort of zeitgeist of America at the time, which said, look, progress is what we're about. We're manifesting destiny. That means the land is here to be used. It's just resources to extract. And he would say, no, we've got to protect this. And luckily, his argument won the day. He pushed for the 1890 Act that created Yosemite National Park. And then he was also instrumental in the creation of multiple other parks. That's why he's called the father of the national park system.
Well, I mean, if there are no kind of base level rules around what's like on the table to develop, you know, to destroy and kind of like piece together other stuff out of, then everything's on the table. So it's very important that this was established when it was, or else you wouldn't have any of that stuff.
No, no. We would pave the world. And now the national park system covers 400 different areas. We're talking about more than 84 million acres across all 50 U.S. states and then the territories and commonwealths, including Saipan, weirdly enough, huge marine reserve. The service employs over 20,000 people. And that's a lot, but it's nowhere near enough to have a single person monitoring every single acre of land. The wildlife is dangerous at times. That means that if you visit national parks, you are responsible for your interactions with the wild animals. It also means that some unscrupulous visitors can get away with breaking the rules, polluting, littering, starting forest fires, and, you know, murdering folks.
Well, and the people that maintain and, you know, watch over these parks do it out of passion. You know, they love it. They're not like highly paid. And oftentimes there's a skeleton crew kind of situation. And if there's ever a government shutdown or funding gets scarce, park maintenance is kind of one of the first things to go. As we saw with Joshua Tree, when there was like a government shutdown and so many people, you know, vandalized and destroyed a lot of the titular Joshua trees.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps most controversially, there is to date, as we record, no official tally of just how many people go missing on public land in the United States. And there's not a great way to fix that either. And we've had episodes with experts in this, such as Professor Brian Kautz, who talked about the zone of death in Yellowstone, and David Politis from Missing 411. But there's another conversation, one that sends a shiver up the spine of true believers. And every year, to be honest, delivers piles of cash to the park system. Guys, there are so many stories of ghosts in these public parks. Let's gather around the campfire, maybe spin some spooky tales.
Ooh. And it's every one. It's every single one, by the way. It's not just a couple of the parks are haunted. Every single one that we've looked at has at least one ghost story, whether it's directly tied to one of the most sought after places in the park, or one of the most sought after inns that is immediately on the park, you know, property or right, like adjacent to it.
Scooby and the gang really have their hands full.
Everybody gets one. Spider-Man rules. Here's where it gets crazy. We're not kidding, fellow conspiracy realists. Now, sure, some of the more skeptical amongst us may automatically roll our eyes or tentacles or algorithms, I guess, at the thought. But you still can't deny millions of visitors appear to at least believe they encountered something in, as you said, Matt, every single national park covered by the Park Service. I mean, we can start with more notorious examples. The Grand Canyon. Dude, honestly, people think the Grand Canyon is haunted. If you've ever been there, it looks haunted. It lives up to the hype. It is indeed grand.
There's stuff in them cracks. And it's probably ghosts.
Sorry. Or ancient civilizations.
Yeah. Ben, what do you think is accomplished by the tentacle rolling? Is it the same kind of thing with an eye roll? It just lets people know.
Yeah. Have you ever bored an octopus? It's very apparent. They do this.
No, dude, they find me fascinating.
When I hear rolled tentacles, I'm picturing like it doing sort of like a breakdancing move, you know?
Nice. And I also wonder, this is unrelated, but this is fascinating. We know the octopus dreams. I wonder if the octopus encounters ghosts or what it thinks of the afterlife. That'd be cool. Story idea.
Octoghosts?
Oh, Octoghosts, yeah.
Have you seen the vampire squid? I mean, that thing's a demon from hell.
There are some new pictures of, I think it's the glass octopus, which is so cool. It's been making the rounds on the nature nerd stuff.
Enough about octopuses. Let's get to El Tovar Hotel.
Yes, known for its octopus ghost. We're kidding, but it is known for ghosts. It's
right known for its exclamation marks.
Oh, gosh, yeah. In a lot of the reporting, Matt, you and I were talking about this off air, and we made a little joke about it in the notes because a lot of places would copy and paste, for lack of a better word, some of the stories and things that come directly from the Grand Canyon's official website. And you can tell because a lot of them end. How'd you put it, Matt? I like the way you put it.
Well, it's ending a sentence as though like all of this was happening at the, or you may think that was spooky, but wait until you hear about the El Tovar Hotel.
And it's almost as if the narrator is turning around dramatically as soon as they say El Tovar Hotel.
Well, yeah, the writing about this hotel, as well as a lot of the other stories we're going to be talking about today, do seem to be stories that would be easily retold by like a guide, let's say, or a bus driver or somebody working at a hotel that's going to tell you about the stories that are occurring within this specific hotel or this national park.
Ring, ring. Hello, it's me, Folklore, right?
Yes.
Because I'm also doing the telephone game.
That's what it feels like. And maybe that's why it's a little frustrating as we're, you know, researching this topic in general. But it's also, it does send tingles up your spine if any of us to believe. So I guess that's what we're on. We're on that journey today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you don't have, I mean, to exercise empathy, right, and understand the perspective, a lot of these people who hear these stories and maybe take them at face value, they've never heard them before. They don't know how often they've been retold. They're hearing them from one person. And that is key, right?
And they're just rolling through for a couple of nights probably, right?
Exactly. Exactly. They want an experience, right? So,
expectation's a hell of a drug.
Right. Yes. Actually, you nailed it. This place, the El Tovar Hotel, is located in a very dramatic spot. It's like about 20 feet from the south rim of the Grand Canyon. It opened in 1905, so before the Grand Canyon National Park was really a thing. And when it opened, it was seen as the absolute peak of luxury, pun very much intended. And I didn't know this, but it was part of a hospitality chain of restaurants and lodgings owned by a guy named Fred Harvey. It was one of the most famous Harvey hotels of the day.
Yeah, and I didn't know what that meant. I had no idea what that meant. The Harvey Company's Mr. Fred Harvey. But this guy was apparently one of the most imagine someone who owns a hotel that's really excited that you're at his hotel. And that is what I see when I imagine Fred Harvey.
Yeah. And he came up along with the age of rail, you know, and so he would purposely build stuff to service passengers on various important railway intersections or passages or stops. And he was an absolute nut about it because he was very good at promoting tourism in the American Southwest.
Looks to have also made a stand in Vegas with things like the Nevada Lake Tahoe Harvey's Resort Hotel and Casino, which comes up if you're Googling like crazy neon signs.
Nice. He also got one of the other things he'll be remembered for is being one of the forces that kind of tamed the Wild West, which was a very short period of American history, but he's the one who was like, let's bring some sit down restaurants where, you know, Harvey Hotel restaurants, you can eat here without being shot.
Well, it's sort of that almost like fantasy of the Wild West that was more sanitized. Like that's a big part of what Vegas was giving people some way to feel like they were participating in that kind of like legacy. But it was all very, you know, kind of buttoned up and like Disneylandish.
Mm-hmm. And this all leads us to El Tovar, because obviously
that sounds so cool and sinister. It's awesome.
Because you have to say it like you've just turned around to announce it to the camera.
El Tovar. Yeah.
Exactly. We should do a commercial for El Tovar. If you're listening, Fred, from the afterlife. So, okay, this thing's been around for more than a century as the ghost stories start. And over time, it gets this reputation for bizarre experiences. The things you'll read most often in sort of the copypasta tour guide notes are a ghostly figure wandering through the front entrance, a painting whose subject appears to like track you wherever you move, and so much more. We'll get to it, but like First, not to be too much of a mythbuster, but we all know what's up with a painting whose eyes seem to follow you wherever you go, because we've all seen that Uncle Sam, I want you for the U.S. Army picture. It's just perspective that you can paint. That does not imply a ghost. That implies a pretty talented artist at best. But it doesn't answer the questions about the, you guys saw the thing about the gravestone, right?
Right. So a lot of these stories around some of these alleged hauntings at the hotel hinge on this mysterious gravestone hidden amidst the foliage to the left across the drive from the front entrance. It's humble, small, and flat on the ground, bearing the very humble, small, and flat inscription, Pearl A. Ward, 1878-1934.
P-I-R-L.
Right. I've never seen that spelling before.
Pearl.
Yeah. And shout out to anybody who just heard the ghostly squelches there as we're talking. That is indeed my stomach. My stomach is now haunted. We'll keep it in.
I need to get you some food, brother.
Get you a meat pie, some fish and chips.
Sure.
Let's everybody guess where Ben is.
Oh gosh. So in the Red Lodge, apparently. So this is weird to me, because we can paint such backstories off such small things. Is Pearl, P-I-R-L, were Pearl's parents perhaps not very literate and wanted to name their kid after something precious? Oh, you know,
it's kind of sad.
Yeah, breaks your heart. But we won't know, because no one is exactly sure who Pearl Ward is or was.
Well, and is the hidden nature of the stone more a product of things were built around it, or was it like obscured for a reason? You know, like the questions do come up.
That is a great question. Yeah. Can the El Tovar somehow not afford landscaping? I mean, is that just not in their budget? Do they want it to seem like it's in disrepair? In some stories, Pearl Ward is a cowboy who dies sort of drifting through the area, and no one knew this person's name when they buried him. In other stories, Pearl is a she. Pearl's a female who is one of the hostesses from the Harvey Hotel. They were called Harvey Girls at the time. And according to that legend, she lived, worked, and died under unknown circumstances on the property.
You should come do on. Ghost tours, Ben. You'd be great.
You should, Ben. But come on, guys. Should. If this is someone who worked at the hotel, there's no record of their passing in the 1930s.
Right, exactly. At that point, they would have had to have something, because it becomes increasingly suspicious, right? Especially if you're living on the property, you're working with tons of other people in this big operation.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, entrepreneurs of that scale in that era would have wanted to cover their butts.
Okay, there's one scenario where I see it working.
Hit it.
The gravestone was created by somebody who knew the truth about what happened to Pearl Ward. That's not actually where Pearl is buried. That has nothing to do with that. It's to remind whoever did it, who works and or owns the hotel, that of what they did to
Pearl. We know what you did last summer.
And every time you leave the property, you got to see her gravestone.
We could also, I mean, maybe that birth and death date, maybe it's some sort of code. Oh, what webs we weave.
And did they plant the hedge around it? Why didn't they just dig it up? You know what I mean? Like,
no one's exhumed it.
Exactly. Yeah.
So is it all smoke and mirrors, or we should say stone and dirt?
Let's get some shovels, boys.
Let's do it. And you know what? When we're digging, what we'll need to do is have two of us dig and one of us be on the lookout.
I call lookout.
Okay, for the caped figure that is often reported to exit the hotel's front stairs and entrance, rocking a black cape, by the way, and then go over to Pearl's grave, hang out there as if in contemplation for a minute, and then wander off behind a nearby building called the Hopi House before disappearing.
Oh, yeah. And this is my favorite part about El Tovar Hotel. There is an elderly gentleman that has been seen walking around. He appears sometimes when there's a big party going on, sometimes when there's no party at all.
Walking the grounds, you say?
Walking the grounds and or the house itself, the hotel. And he's often giving you a little, like if you walk up to him as a guest or walk past him, he's just kind of there for a moment. He's like, hey, make sure you head up to the ballroom. We got the big gathering, the get together. It's going to be a swell time. Head on up there. And guess who people think that is?
Is it Fred Harvey?
Oh, Fred Harvey. but there is, it does get a little weirder because people see him all over the place, right? Or somebody that they attribute to Fred Harvey. But the timeline maybe doesn't match up so good.
Yeah, the profiling's a little weird too because old man is not, you know, the most specific thing. And, you know, the spooky dookie part is when they show up at this party, there's no record of them being invited. They're like, this old man told me. And they're like, what old man?
Yeah. You've always been the caretaker, sir.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Or there's no party at all.
Or there's
and
no
the hotel
party at all.
Staff is like, what are you talking about?
Yeah,
no.
we don't have a holiday party for Arbor Day, my friends.
I've always thought it was so interesting that Stanley Kubrick, being such a snob, glommed on to The Shining, because it is a bit of a broad, you know, Stephen King is a bit of a broad writer. But The Shining, there's something about it that does capitalize on all of this stuff we're talking about. The idea of haunted places, the idea of like, what is the history, the tortured kind of legacy of a place or whatever it might be. And a hotel is the perfect kind of like location for stuff like that.
Yeah, it's a liminal space.
Exactly. Think about how difficult it would have been to create a giant hotel at the edge of the Grand Canyon in the early 1900s, right? Late 1800s to the like brand new 1900s. You're having that stuff built, and people are probably getting maimed and injured really badly because you're so far from civilization, right? And there's you can't send them on over to the local doctor because there's no local doctor, you know, for a couple hundred miles or whatever.
Right.
Like that's insane, first of all. And also, I think this is for me the reasoning behind the Fred Harvey sightings. If you were able to achieve that feat of creating a giant building out in the wilderness like that, you would be massively proud of it, right? Or I think likely you'd be massively proud of it. And it would be not only an achievement of human ingenuity, but placing it where it is, to be able to look from within that place you built, looking out upon the Grand Canyon, must be, I don't know, very close to religious or spiritual.
It's Ozymandias.
Right?
Look upon my work, see mighty. And there's one catch, though. As much as I agree with you there, Matt, on that excellent observation, Fred never got to see this particular feat because he himself passed away in 1901, 4 years before the completion of El Tovar.
Well, so that's why he's there, Ben, because he never got to see it in real life. So now he's got to hang out there for an eternity.
And just give people, like, be their personal concierge, you know?
And
like,
lie to them about when the party's going?
Well, no. In his timeline, there is a party, and he's super excited about it, and he's, like, hyped, right?
Time is a loop. Exactly. It's like a superimposed reality.
And I love it. I'm a huge I actually kind of believe in some of that stuff, but our beliefs are our own. This is one of the most famous stories, but there are two other incidents. You can find them reported in the local newspapers, usually around Halloween, to be honest with you. There's a couple from New Jersey, and in this story, no timeline attributed. This is the Griffiths couple, and they woke up in the night. The wife woke up because an unseen presence was, quote, pulling on her clothing in the middle of the night. I don't know about you guys, but when I first read that, I immediately thought there was a ghost who was like, get dressed, lady, and started like throwing her dress on or her slacks or whatever. But no, it was just like tugging at her PJs.
I saw this meme the other day where it was like every H.P. Lovecraft story. It's like, I saw a monster. Like, what was it like?
It was indescribable.
Exactly. Yeah,
I can't describe it, but let me spend four pages doing just that. Shout out Lovecraft. God, I like Lovecraft. But he had some problematic views. Yeah.
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 But as for the clothes pulling, that's weird. I would not enjoy that. But, you know, maybe your clothes got stuck. Or maybe I would enjoy it. I don't know.
You know, man. Situations.
Just give it a go.
I guess it depends.
Have you guys seen that that film from back in the day called High Spirits, starring Liam Neeson?
Was this when he was in his rom-com era, kind of?
It's a 1988 fantasy comedy about is it Liam Neeson? Yeah, it is Liam Neeson. It's about a haunted castle that is being turned into a tourist destination, and the ghosts have, you know, lovable hijinks, Beetlejuice-esque, with a visiting couple, played by Daryl Hannah and Steve Guttenberg.
Oh, Daryl Hannah was such a babe.
There's a clothes pulling scene in there that may not have aged well.
I cannot believe Steve Guttenberg was ever like a leading man. He is like, Daryl Hannah is so above Steve Guttenberg's pay grade, it's not even funny.
Well, you know, Hollywood magic, right? Speaking of Hollywood magic, there's a couple from Los Angeles who said the following at the El Tovar. They walked past their television and stopped because when they looked at the screen, there was the face of a bearded old man peering back at them. And I was trying to figure out more about this tale, which gets just tossed around so often. It doesn't seem that any investigator asked them, well, was the television on? I feel like that might explain it.
Yeah, it was the duck. What was a duck show with all the big bearded guys? Duck Hunters?
Duck Hunters. Duck Dynasty.
Duck Dynasty.
The Duck Show with all the, oh, wow, I got there, but.
Yeah. Was it a reflection in the black mirror, right? Was the person actually in the room?
Perhaps the guy just needed a shave and didn't realize how much he'd let himself go.
Maybe it was a window and they didn't understand televisions. I don't know.
Dude.
Maybe they were just, I'm going to say it, maybe they were high.
High spirits indeed. By the way, I was just watching a trailer for that movie. I've never seen hide nor hair of this, and it looks like a delight.
It's fun. I loved it. It's a fun romp.
It's got serious vibes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
It's of that era, you know.
It's of that era, but not of that caliber. So
there are a couple other things in Grand Canyon really quickly. I just want to throw out here if anybody ends up going there. Because I've not been and I want to go now.
Oh, you should go.
Of course. There's a place called the Phantom Ranch that exists there this thing called Phantom Ranch. It's the property, I guess, that's called the Phantom Ranch. There's a place called Phantom Creek within the park that is immediately adjacent to it. And according to the stories, the folklore, there's this guy named John Wesley Powell who set that thing up. Right. This is in the 1860s, 1870s when all of this is happening. And he's this one armed person who was in the Civil War. He's considered a hero. He did not die there, according to the folklore. But again, kind of like how we were joking around about Mr. Harvey. Mm-hmm. It's thought that this guy was proud of this achievement it was in some way impactful in his life. So his spirit haunts this Phantom Ranch, which is aptly named, I must say. But it does.
Again, very Scooby-Doo. Sorry. The Phantom Ranch. Scooby-Doo and the Phantom Ranch. You know?
It does. But there's the little twist thing to it. And that a lot of the folklore in the Grand Canyon, I feel like, has this kind of thing. There's another place within the Grand Canyon called Bright Angel Creek. And there were huge stones from that creek bed in that area that were used to build a lot of the structures in Phantom Ranch. So you've got angels worked in there, right? And phantoms just in the names, which feels like a great way to sell people on going.
And rumors of giants back in the days. There was also, of course, we're not joking about the ancient civilization thing. Check out our earlier episode on that. That was a weird comment on reporting of the time as well.
Yes. Yes. And one other thing, guys, this story of we've heard so many tales like this when we've covered ghost stories. A crying woman right? Mm-hmm. Out in the woods somewhere that you can't really see this person, but you hear the wailing.
La Llorona. Yeah,
exactly that. But it's again, a twist on that, right? You can look up a place called Transept Trail, Transept Trail, where I think it was the 1930s. There's a place called the Grand Canyon Lodge that burned up. Mm-hmm. And after that fire, it's thought that some spirit involved in some way haunts that area
of, to this day, to this very day.
And here we can already see those common traits of folklore. Stories told repeatedly, small changes over time, give it a twist to make your La Llorona different. And then there's always a lack of certain specificity. It adds to the overall mystery, and at the same time, it makes it increasingly difficult to nail down some concrete facts. We'll see this in other ghost stories as well. What do you guys think? Should we take a break and go to some more examples?
Absolutely.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Classes in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision?
Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel.
Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI.
There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better.
In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces.
So tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow.
Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we have returned. Now we're traveling to Yellowstone. And you know, we talked about this a little bit off air. You can find the history of Yellowstone Park, the history of all these parks, really. We're not going to spend too much time on them. We wanted to get to some of the juicy ghost stories. Speaking of haunted female figures, haunted women, here's one, Matt Knoll. We, I think, all read about this one. The Headless Bride of the Old Faithful Inn. Yet again, another inn with an interesting, unique experience of the paranormal.
Yeah, it's an inn, but it's not in love. You know what I'm saying? Don't force others to marry people they don't want to marry. That's the story of the Old Faithful Inn.
Just don't do it. Even when you know it's not going to work out, don't do it. You know what I mean? You got to let people do what they want. And you can find this story of the Headless Bride all over the place, including the official website, yellowstonepark.com. It goes like this. Back in 1915, there's this guy in New York, and he's sort of a blue blood. He's the one percenter of his day. He owns a shipping company, country here. He owns a shipping company, and he's got a rebellious teenage daughter just full of hijinks, and he has arranged a marriage for her with a young guy from an equally wealthy New York family. But she says, no, you can't control me, old man. I'm in love with an unnamed household servant.
Right. Right. So dad's like, oh, this guy's got bad intentions, unnamed person. But, you know, despite the father's, let's say, issues with the person that his daughter's going to marry, she went ahead and did it. She got hitched.
She did indeed. She said, unnamed older household servant, I am in love with you. And the dad was mad about this, but she would brook no argument. He tried to talk her out of it, and he said, look, this is not just me being a stodgy, bossy old man. I am genuinely concerned that this dude's intentions for you are not romantic. I think he has an evil, sinister plan. And, you know, in the modern day parlance, he thinks that this guy's a gold digger. And she says, I'm not going to hear it. She goes ahead, she gets married, and the father tries to make a poison pill, as we would call it in corporate mergers and acquisitions. He says, okay, if you guys want to get married, I will give you an extravagant dowry as your wedding gift. And as a condition of this dowry, you have to agree, you as a couple have to agree that you are getting no more additional support from our family ever. You're not getting an inheritance. You're not getting a share of the business. Fleetwood Mac style, go your own way. And as a matter of fact, you need to leave New York forever. According to the story, this was a bluff on the father's part. He thought this would force these people to call off the wedding because it would remove the servant's access to the larger fortune. His gamble was a failure. The couple said, okay, yeah, we agree because we're so much in love. We're going to go have a baller honeymoon at Yellowstone, and we're going to stay at the hottest inn for we're going to stay at the hottest inn for honeymoons, the Old Faithful Inn. And there's a little specificity here because they were staying at room 127. That doesn't always happen in these ghost stories. We know the Old Faithful Inn was pretty new at the time. It was still less than 10 years old. It was the seen and be seen place for family vacations. But as we heard from various versions of the legend, things went wrong for the couple very quickly.
Yeah. Why is it important that they were in room 127? Well, that's because there was a huge argument in that room that other people heard on, let's say, the fateful night. And why were they arguing? This is a happy new couple. They're on their honeymoon. Well, according to the story, it's because the new husband basically did kind of what the father was warning the daughter he was going to do or what he was about. Allegedly, according to the stories, he was gambling a ton and not just while hanging out somewhere at the Old Faithful Inn, while they were making their way to the inn, right? And hanging out in taverns, spending a ton of money on drinks and all that kind of stuff. And they were arguing because basically the guy blew through all the money they had and they couldn't even afford to pay the bill at the Old Faithful.
Right. Which makes the staff a lot less helpful. And about a month into the honeymoon, you know, they're skint.
Which is a long honeymoon, my God.
I was thinking that too. You know what I mean? Like, I get that they're wealthy, but I read that with no small amount of envy. It's up there with the idea of people in this in that day and age saying, oh, well, we're abroad to Europe for the summer. I do love the continent. Not too long a stay, merely a third month or so. And it was just a different world, right? Because it would take a significant amount of work for us, any of us, to figure out a way to not be at work for a month. But there we have it. And it turns out that kind of privilege doesn't necessarily make people happy. Like you said, Matt, it goes to this one night. The couple had already been arguing on a regular basis. It was the scandal of the hotel. And The daughter had called her father for help, and he refused. Kind of cold, but he set those terms. And during this very violent, louder-than-usual shouting match on this evening, the husband storms out, never to be seen again. The hotel staff gives the bride her privacy for a while. After about 2 days, it's a weird number, but after about 2 days, they go to room 127 to check on her. She's not
going to be like, where is our money?
Right. And also, sorry about your loss. Also, you owe us for this plus these other 2 days. Call your dad. And the maid who is looking around, because you know how hotels are laid out. When you walk in, there might be a foyer or a hallway, and you'll see like a maybe a living room suite or a bedroom first. You have to walk into the restroom. It's not clearly visible. So she walks into the restroom or the bathroom, and she screams because the bride's corpse is filling the bathtub. It's riddled with blood. It's a Dexter-level or Hannibal-level crime scene. It's got all the ingredients of true crime, except one thing's missing, her head.
Yeah. Yeah. Head's missing. Body's in there. Lots of blood. Not great. Not great. For the bathtub, for, you know, the reputation of the hotel, especially for the new bride, probably right. Not great for her. And they basically looked for the head. They didn't notice the husband carrying, you know, a human head when he stormed out, which, you know, obviously he is the suspect, right? The last person to be seen with this person. They were arguing a whole lot. I think the tales say they searched the property for like a week or maybe even longer.
Yeah. They searched up and down across the hotel property for at least a week. The amount of time they spent searching varies depending on the version of the tale you hear, but it was definitely more than just like a one afternoon search. We know this because they did eventually find the head. They found it due to the smell emanating from an elevated area, the highest interior point of the hotel, called the Crow's Nest, where the band would play. And just to pause there, that's a really cool idea to have the band playing from that elevated area. But somebody got a bad whiff, figured out something was rotten in the Crow's Nest, and they went up there, and you guessed it, that's where they found the head, rotting away. And ever since then, guests have reported seeing a ghostly woman walking down the stairs of the Crow's Nest in her white dress, carrying her head under her arm. This is brought to you by Under Armour. Sorry.
Yep.
I'm sorry, man.
No, it's totally fine. But, you know, this is one of those stories where it's on the official website.
It very much is. It's on the official website. It's on numerous blogs about the area. You can find it published as fact in multiple, like, collection of paranormal things, paperbacks, you know, which we grew up loving. And you have to ask yourself, is this true? Is this false? Is this embellished?
Well, it's got to be helping the hotel in some way to even be – to have a place on their website, right?
Exactly.
If it hurt, you would just leave it off.
Mm-hmm.
And you could, you know, anyone who was interested could go to any other blog that's out there that writes about these things. But if you went to the official Yellowstone website, it's not there, leaving everybody who is, you know, thinking about going, oh, well, maybe that's just a tall tale. When you put it on the website like that, I feel like it gives it such credence or it lends so much more
credibility.
I guess it is credibility.
Legitimacy.
It's just weird to do that unless it's going to make some profit.
Exactly. It's what we kind of were setting up at the top and through all this. We can tell you the truth about this story for sure. It's this. Ghosts are only real when someone was decapitated. It's the only time. Scientifically proven. That's why the headless horseman is a thing. Yeah, it's proven. French Revolution. That's why they still have ghosts.
Dang.
Or we're funning with you, just like the assistant manager of the Old Faithful Inn, George Borman, who made the whole thing up. He's got a 1991 interview with Deseret News, and he says, okay, here's what happened. I was in the hotel one time when it was deserted, overlook style, and I heard some footsteps down the hallway. And I walked out and looked because there was nobody there but me and one or two other employees. And I couldn't find anybody who could have run down that hallway at that time outside of my room. And so I went and looked again, and I saw nobody. He says he went and looked three times. And he said later, this got him thinking, huh, what if there was a ghost story for the Old Faithful Inn? That would be interesting. That would add a hint of mystery to the inn's vibes. And so he says he made the whole thing up in 1983. And then ever since that moment, because he was still working there for a while, he says people would come to him and repeat the fictitious story to him. And like even to the point of like mansplaining his own story to him.
Nice. There's more telephone details, sir, to this story. That's fascinating. It checks out to me.
However, not all of the ghostly activities or alleged paranormal experiences of these different parks have such simple explanations. And you know, I think it's really important for us to point out as well that it goes into this expectation idea that Noel mentioned earlier, the idea that we have to, the idea that people came into Old Faithful having heard that story, perhaps accepted it as fact, and were therefore on some level primed to see or experience something. However, we have other cases where the answer is not so clear cut. We got to go to a cool place next, a place called Mammoth Cave. And, you know, we were talking about this off air. Mammoth Cave, when we say we want to go to it, we don't just mean go to it in this conversation. We want to go as a crew.
Yeah. Well, let's just go ahead and mention it at the top. We want to do this thing called the Violet City Lantern Tour.
Yes.
Because this, okay, so Mammoth Cave, it's the longest known cave system in the world. It's got 426 miles worth of cave that you can kind of check out. Some of the areas you can't check out. And there are new areas being discovered still, which is
right.
Mind-blowing.
We don't know the extent. Also, I love this worth of cave. Like, yeah. How many miles worth of cave is this before I pay for the tour?
426 miles. And what they do with this, I was going to say velvet, with this Violet City Lantern Tour, is they shut down all the lights because there's a ton of human-made light that exists in the cave system so that when people go on tours, they can see, right? Nobody gets hurt. There's illumination via electricity throughout the cave system. But in these tours, they turn off those lights and they've got lanterns and they take you through the cave by lantern light. I want to do that because it appears that there's more than just bats down in them caves. Oh, there's coughing. Wait a second. I know this story, Ben.
Also, we should mention this story scares our colleague Noel so much that he has left the episode for today. Actually, we're kidding. He's a little bit under the weather with the bit of a cough and will be rejoining us soon. But for now, he gives us his blessing and wishes us to continue the subterranean exploration.
Oh, yes. So let's put our minds in the place of being inside a system that consists of 426 miles of cave. Worth of cave. Imagine being there deep beneath, within the earth, let's say, and just what the tricks your mind would play on you and the otherworldly things you might imagine could be down there. Right?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, it's true because subterranean flora and fauna are still being discovered. We don't know how far these cave systems go. We don't know what's living in there. There's some cave systems that are, for all intents and purposes, sealed off. They've become their own ecosystems, unreliant upon sunlight and all those things surface dwellers love. We can also say that for most people, you have never been in absolute darkness. And being in absolute darkness will lead you to hallucinate.
Yes. Now let's bring in the history of this cave system, or at least the like American version, I guess, the Anglo-centric existence of this cave and the history of that, because it gets dark pretty quickly. Wasn't it purchased for some, I mean, I guess it was a fairly large sum back then, but like $10,000 US?
Yes, $10,000 in 1839. And we can borrow a bit from our handy inflation calculator. $10,000 in 1839 is the equivalent of $329,834 today. So very expensive, but still, that's a lot cheaper than I thought a cave system would cost.
Yeah, a huge cave system that was not, again, like, it not its super early stages of mapping, but early, right? Mm-hmm. A lot has been discovered since then. But he didn't just buy the cave system itself and the property above the caves. He also bought humans.
He did. The deal included, you know, adjacent property, and they defined adjacent property as also enslaved human beings, because again, this was 1839. And one of the enslaved people that he took ownership of as part of this deal was a cave guide named Stefan Bishop. And at this point, Bishop probably knew the caverns better than any other person alive. And I really appreciate that you point out we're starting the story from the kind of Anglo-centric view, because native populations, again, knew about this cave for thousands and thousands and thousands of years.
Bishop, it is a celebrated, important place for those cultures. It's not it's not just a cave.
It has immense cultural and spiritual significance. Dr. Krogan does not care about that. He doesn't give a damn about it. He immediately starts tours. And so Stefan Bishop is giving people these amazing tours. He's showing them Echo River, where blind albino fish have evolved, miles of all these unique twisting passageways. Meanwhile, on the surface, Dr. Krogan is busying himself brainstorming new ways to monetize this natural wonder, to turn it into a cash cow, to make his 10,000 back as soon as possible, and then just make more and more money. And you and I were talking off air about his strange idea, one of the strangest that he put into place. It was the idea that he could build a special camp inside the cave for people suffering from tuberculosis, or consumption, as it was called in the day.
I don't know. I think it's a good idea for something to try.
It's worth trying. Agreed.
You know, well, because there wasn't a lot known about what could actually, like, what are the conditions that would help someone get over tuberculosis, right? Mm-hmm. And the thought came up, well, what if relatively low temperatures of the cave system compared to the outside world at the time, what if those temperatures would be conducive to reducing the effects of tuberculosis on the human body? Maybe. Mm-hmm. Again, maybe. Worth a shot.
Yeah.
So they actually built a fairly large area. There are several, they call them huts, but they're these like, they look almost like it does look like a hut, I guess, but it's a mini little stone and wooden structure.
Yeah, you call it a hut, call it a cabin, somewhere in between.
Yeah, they're tiny, but it's enough for a human being to be in, and not to live comfortably, but to survive, right? Mm-hmm. I think I don't know how many they built, but they built a bunch of them, and there are two that remain to this day that you can go visit.
I think most of the reporting I read said that he originally had 11 huts built in there, and the idea was that you would get 15 patients, which means some of the patients were couples, because that's, you know, or maybe parent and child or siblings. But they say 15 patients arrived. And honestly, folks, we don't know whether these patients genuinely believe this treatment would work, but we can only imagine given what you described, Matt, at this time, that they were desperate enough to try anything. You know, that's kind of, it's like when we look at cancer cure conspiracies and the con artist involved in sort of bilking desperate people. As far as we can tell, Dr. Krogan is not himself a con artist. He is actually trying to see whether this will assist people who are suffering from consumption. However, as history will prove, this treatment did not work. Two patients died that same year. All 15 of the patients got worse. Dr. Krogan himself would go on to die from tuberculosis in 1849.
Yeah, 10 years after he bought the cave system, he dies of tuberculosis too. So you might imagine, there's been some death in this cave that we know of, and we can attribute tuberculosis to those deaths. That disease comes with a lot of coughing. It would make sense, right, to hear coughing in the distance somewhere within the cave system, right, as you're touring through it, especially by lantern light.
Especially by lantern, yeah. If you elect to take the Violet City tour of the cave, the tour guides will take you to that blackout, like you described, Matt, where you actually go down into the dark that most people have not experienced. And then they'll give you the tour with the oil lamp, and they'll tell you the stories, and you can actually see remnants of this tuberculosis camp experiment. That is a real thing. That's not a legend. And some rangers will tell you that they have experienced strange things down there, that they have seen shoves from unseen forces. They've heard inexplicable footsteps or coughing in the distance, or even being grabbed or touched when they knew there were no other people around. I have a question for you, man, because, you know, I go to you for audio advice often. Is it possible with the acoustics of a cavern that you could prank someone with ghost coughing? Like, could you be far enough away around a bend or something and cough and have the cough reflect off the stone to reach the person observing the camp?
I don't know the science behind that, Ben. What I would do is get a really long tube that is highly flexible. Okay. I would set it up at one end of it higher up in the cave system, and then I would have it go all the way down to lower in the cave system. And I would do a little cough into the tube, okay, right, at one side or the other, and make everybody think the cough's coming from way up there or way down there.
Clever. Okay, because I was thinking you might say set up like a time delay motion sensor with a speaker so that it doesn't start coughing right when you trip the wire but it starts coughing, you know, 4 minutes after or something like that.
I love the way you think, and it's high tech. I'm going to say the tube system is the way I'm going. Imagine the sound of dragging the tube back to your location after you've used it.
How long is this tube? Wait,
it's
hang on.
Huge.
Great. This is an awkward thing. You know what? Let's do both. Why not? Okay. Let's do both. How much will they sell the caves for? We do have specific folks. Like one guide, Larry Purcell, had another story. He went on record and he said that he experienced something unrelated to the tuberculosis camp that terrified him. He said he was giving a tour, and during some part of this tour, it was the Violet City tour, he noticed an African-American family standing behind the rest of the group. And he was surprised to see them because he hadn't noticed any African-American tourist in this particular group. And he said, it's crazy. The father is wearing a white Panama hat and he's watching with rapt attention as we were giving the oil lamp tour, right? And then when you reach the part where they turn off the oil lamp and turn the electric lights back on, he looks for this family and he can't find anybody. There were just extra people there when the oil lamp was on.
Yeah, no thanks. extra people while the oil lamp was on. Don't like that phrase. Don't like anything about it. So,
yeah, it reminds me when we went on our brief excursion to the Hoover Dam. I think that's a close recent comparison for us. Hoover Dam, very much a man-made cavern, but What we saw is that the tour guides at regular frequent intervals were counting the number of people in the group.
That's why.
That's why.
Because sometimes there are extra families.
Oh, man. I love that idea. Okay, so do octopus believe in ghosts, and then the extra tour guide members. Okay. Yep. Gold, Jerry. We're making gold here, Rumpelstiltskin style. All right. Apparently, the room where the ranger saw this family is called the Methodist Church because miners used to have religious services there when they were exploring resources in the cave. And during those days, because of the rampant racism, if a African American guide or his family attended the services, they would have to stand back at a distance.
Wow.
I know, it's a bummer. And those two things aren't necessarily related. They're the kind of things that have just enough commonality for people to put some red string together, turn down the lights, and tell you it's scary.
Yeah. You know what? Why don't we pause here? We got a few more parks to visit before we're done today, but we need to hear a word from our sponsor. So we'll be right back.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision?
Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts season two of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel.
Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI.
There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better.
In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces.
So tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow.
Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we have returned. Let's visit, you know, if we don't do anything else, let's at least visit the Devil's Den. We've got other places to go. Like you said, Matt, every single national park has some kind of ghost story. And we will tell you why, by the way, at the end. But the Devil's Den is in Gettysburg National Military Park. Matt, have you visited Gettysburg?
I feel like I did as a kid, but I have no recollection of actually going through there.
Yeah,
because it's getting muddled with other Civil War parks I've been to.
Right, because we've seen a lot of Civil War parks in our time. Yeah, this is a site commemorating one of the most historically significant and a very bloody battle of the U.S. Civil War. There is a site in the park called the Devil's Den. It's world famous amid paranormal investigators, ghost hunters, psychics, you name it. And it's really interesting to look at pictures because it's like, imagine if you are a Union or Confederate soldier and you are in the midst of, you know, unreliable ammunition. You're probably not feeling great because you've been malnourished. You're probably suffering from some disease and you're being forced to fight Napoleonic style, which means you're told to line up and then just sort of march at each other and hope you don't get shot. It's a really shitty way to wage war, honestly. If you're in that situation, you need to make friends with geography. So a place with a bunch of boulders is great. You can break up your death march line. You can hide behind rocks long enough to reload without getting shot. The same advantage carries on to the enemy forces. So it's no surprise that the Devil's Den became a bloodbath.
Yeah, it did. I kind of want to describe it a little bit more. You found a great description from someone named Mark Nesbitt, and I guess we should just – the quote is awesome, Ben. Do you want to just do it?
You should do it. You should do it.
All right. Well, okay. This is what it looks like according to Mark Nesbitt, who was a paranormal investigator and a former park ranger, which that is very important. Here's how he describes it. Quote, "The Devil's Den looks like some giant just dropped these huge boulders the size of houses down onto this one spot on the battlefield. On a sunny day, it's not too bad. On a cloudy day, it's kind of ominous. At night, it's just ridiculous."
Yeah, exactly. I love
like
that.
As in, it's creepy, right? That's what he's implying.
Yeah, yeah. And I like to point out he is a former park ranger. He's also the owner of the Ghost of Gettysburg Tours. He's coming there with experience, but also it's good for him if you go on a ghost tour.
Yep.
So that's the way to say it. He said he would often get the willies when he was just walking around the area at night doing security checks. And he spoke in depth with our pals at How Stuff Works about this, our alma mater, How Stuff Works. And he wrote a book series, I should say, called Ghost of Gettysburg, wherein he chronicles a lot of unexplained experiences at Devil's Den. And they have all the, you know, all the usual stripes of folklore, right? Often unnamed people. The timeline is a little vague, but the experience itself is sobering. One lady said she was climbing around the boulders with a friend. She felt a hand grab her ankle. Could it be her friend? She looks down. She sees a ghostly soldier grabbing for her. She screams for help. She looks up. Oh, and there's her friend. Her friend's not touching her at all. She looks back down. The man's gone.
Whoa.
Ooh, stranger danger.
Gotta love a good ankle grab.
Let's take Paul. Can we cut that and keep it out of context? I'll never forget what my good friend Matt told me all those years ago. You gotta love a good ankle grab.
I don't know how that would be used in a weird way, but that's to me just that's one of the creepiest things I remember having to me as a kid. My sister like be under the bed and grab my ankle.
Yeah, it's frightening, right? It's a very vulnerable part of your body. And then additionally, since you're laying down, you're trying to go to sleep. That's terrifying. That's terrifying to the point where even if you know how it happened, like you see your sister, I would still be furious.
Yeah. It was fun though. I think that's why I like horror movies now. I'm not sure.
Hmm. We enjoy the things that scarred us, right? I'm in a similar situation. Well, there's the other one that's a little bit less weird, which is, did you see this, the helpful hippie story?
Yeah, this one's great. This one's like, oh man, I'm lost. Where do I go? I don't know what to do. And then an apparition appears out of nowhere and says, it's over there, man.
Exactly.
That way. Look, where you're looking for is over there.
And then you look in that direction, and then you look back, and he's gone.
Wow.
And he's like flower child, weird hat, all like picture the hippie. It's the hippie stereotype. He's got a shoulder length hair, bare feet, you know. And Nesbitt says this. We'll give you what Nesbitt says first. He says, I can't believe she's describing exactly what a Texan looked like at the Battle of Gettysburg. She would not have known that as a tourist. However, with great respect, Mr. Nesbitt, we have a proposition for you here. A lot of people do live off the grid in national parks, you know, and there are people who wander from park to park or live a nomadic existence, like the people who follow rainbow gatherings, things like that, you know. What are they called? Rubber tramps, you know, train hoppers. People are living outside of the system. I think it's completely possible. A lot of those people, by the way, are very, very cool. I think it's completely possible that there could just be a guy living out around that area who shows up and helps people.
Amongst the stones.
Amongst the stones. Stones.
I love it. Wait, speaking of stones, this is an interjection, everyone. Ben, I was looking at Death Valley, and I know we looked at that one too, because there's a national park called the Death Valley National Park, and they've got this phenomena that I think we've mentioned before, but we haven't looked into it in detail, but it's these stones that are heavy and stone, and somehow, without any intervention by human hands or seemingly animal hands, they move.
Yeah, they sort of slide along.
It's a dry lake bed where these stones are, and they move. And you can see the trails of these stones having moved over time. No footprints, no any just explanation outside of, oh, those stones move, I guess.
Right. And also, when you see that, you're already in Death Valley. So your primary concern is, man, I hope I get water before I die.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just really cool because there are like pretty good scientific concepts, ideas about what could make those stones do that.
Mm-hmm.
It has a lot to do with ice forming when it gets super cold, but like small amounts of ice forming amidst all the particles, right? You imagine of sand and dust and all that other stuff that's out there. Somehow when there's enough lubrication right at the like front facing part of that stone, and then there's a strong enough wind, and then all these other factors could potentially make it happen.
It removes the friction.
Right? Maybe.
Yeah. I mean, that's the idea. Also, because that area is so dry, so arid, there's the idea that like the flash floods that occasionally, or the rain that occasionally occurs plays a part. I think there is a scientific explanation. I'm with you though. As to my knowledge, and this may be incorrect, there is no documented like video footage of them moving. It's just point A and then point B.
Not to cut you off, Ben, I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding anyone out there that's listening right now. I'm sitting in my house. My son and my mother are downstairs hanging out. Mm-hmm. My dogs are both asleep behind me, well behind me.
Yeah.
As you were talking, Ben, I felt something touch my leg and then my shoulder, and that was it. And there's nobody around me. I'm not
kidding.
That's
weird. I can confirm, by the way, that we saw Matt look down first at his left leg and then at his right, and then look behind him. And because you were so crazy polite, you were like, hey, not to cut you off, but.
I'm just kind of sitting with the feeling in this moment, but okay. Harvey?
Javi, he heard you were talking smack about El Tovar.
There's so much more to learn about all of these parks. Again, we mentioned there's not a single park, I think, that you can look up that doesn't have something haunted. Look up the twice hanged man, also in Death Valley. Story of a guy who allegedly killed a banker, got convicted, got hanged. Then he was cut down. Then he was put back up, hanged again for like a press opportunity. This is in 1908 in a place called Skidoo. Really, it's called Skidoo, S-K-I-D-O-O. You can see remnants of the town that are still out there in Death Valley. There is so much to that story, but allegedly the medical practitioners at the time cut his head off to see if he had syphilis or some other brain disease that would cause his erratic behavior. Cause he was a pretty well-known businessman at the time. He was well-known in the town and he killed a allegedly beloved banker. And so they're like, what the heck caused him to do this? So they supposedly cut his head off. And now, even now, you can see basically this headless ghost that's walking around trying to find his head.
Wild. Again, like we said, it's scientifically proven that the only real ghosts are people who have been decapitated.
There you go.
You know, don't get mad at us, folks. That's just science. And also don't fact check us on that one. But we might even return with more ghosts from national parks because, like you said, Matt, there are so very many out there. If we did one for every national park, we'd be looking at over 400.
Yeah.
Well over.
Dude, the Indiana Dunes, and look up Diana of the Dunes. That's a thing. Diana of the Dunes. It's a fascinating, great, actually wholesome ghost story, if you want to check that one out.
Look up also all the myths surrounding mounds, burial mounds, which were around, you know, well before the idea of the United States. And indeed, they were actively suppressed by the United States, in some cases destroyed. And also, if you happen to live near any, take the time to go visit them. It's a fascinating peek into the hidden history of this continent.
Last one, Ben. If you have ever gone through, it's the Smoky Mountains. What's that one called? Great Smoky Mountain National Park, I think is the name of it. Mm-hmm. There's an area. Oh, let me see if I can find it. It's called the Thomas Divide Ridge, where you can find, you could find the Thomas Divide Overlook that is on one of the main roads there.
Uh-huh.
If you look out at night at this Thomas Divide Ridge, allegedly you can see lights that flicker and shine in this area that is not populated. They call them the ghost lights, Smoky Mountain ghost lights. I have seen video of these things, but I've never heard anyone give a better explanation, I guess, for what it possibly could be.
Because it can't be swamp gas, right?
I don't think it's mountain gas, baby.
I've had mountain gas before.
Me too.
Oh, boy. Yes, we're talking about this off air. I think that one could be an entire episode because we can take what we learned from previous ghost light conversations and will-o'-the-wisp things and kind of case test, right?
Yeah, I just want to go. I want to go spend a couple nights out there in the wilderness on the ridge that you can view from the street there.
Yeah.
Because you can get footage of it from a certain angle. I want to know if the angle of observation has anything to do with the way the light looks, right?
Yeah, yeah. You were saying we need to find the specific spot. Right. And it could be a multi-person operation, too, where we find the specific spot and we have one person stay there, maintain that. And then we have somebody else try to move toward it and see what they can. I don't know. We could triangulate. We could do some interesting things, especially in the age of GPS.
Dude, it's not that far from us. It's Tennessee, right? That's it's hours, but we could make it.
Yeah, we can make it happen. We can also, you know what? Let's tell the bosses this is valuable research and that we don't have time to explain why we can't be in the meetings.
guys, we are exploring the wilderness.
Call into the meeting from there. Where are
I'm sure
you guys?
That would go great. Do they make satellite phones still, right?
They do. Okay, so we'll get with accounting first to get the sat phone. And then we will, okay, yeah, wheels are spinning. I think we got this.
Yeah, X-37B is still up there. It's going to be there for a while. We'll be able to make contact.
Yeah, who knows? We'll ring out there into the ink, and we might get X-37B. We might get the Chinese one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know how to say hello in all those languages. It'll work out. So
That's why I'm sticking with you, buddy.
We'll see. That's why I'm sticking with you. That's why we hope you are sticking with us. We'd like to answer this question, folks. Why would national parks in particular garner so many tales of ghostly activity? Well, without saying whether or not ghosts are real, we can tell you expectation plays a big role. You were talking about this a little bit too, Matt. When people enter a place being told perhaps numerous times that paranormal activity might be present, on some level of consciousness, even if you're a skeptic saying, I'll disprove this, you're going to be more primed to look for unusual things. Some stuff that you might ignore otherwise become, you know, takes on other implications, right? Like if you're in a grocery store or in a crowded part of your city or town, there are a lot of things you ignore just to get by. You know other people are around. You know there's going to be other stimuli hitting your wonderful sensory network. But if you're in a new environment where people have already told you, look out for that headless person, then you have a higher likelihood of feeling like a visual movement you can't track, in the distance or something comes from somewhere beyond the mundane realm. And I think that's something we have to remember. Plus, it makes for a heck of a story. And we did reach out to the National Park System. We went to the top of this one, folks. And what we found is that there's so many allegations of ghosts in individual parks that the best way to learn more is to contact the parks directly. And they'll answer you because they are awesome, tireless people. The rangers and other officials who maintain these resources are, in our opinion, heroes. And I don't know, man. It's something you said earlier, which I think is such a good point. We have to applaud the willingness of the park system to, let's say, play along, or maybe let's say encourage interest in natural and human history. They've got a sense of humor as well as respect. And they're kind of leveraging the interest in the paranormal as a way of encouraging interest in the stunning, very real beauty of the world around us.
Yes. Yes.
So if it's a conspiracy, it's like a good conspiracy.
It's a wholesome conspiracy. Again, it makes you want to do like what? I probably wouldn't want to travel to Chickamauga, which is another place in Tennessee. It's like it's an historic national landmark, I guess, kind of and it's got a forest connected with a natural area. It's another Civil War related thing. And I would never go there, but there's a thing there called Old Green Eyes. That's allegedly this thing at night that you can see. I want to go see Old Green Eyes way more than I want to see the Civil War history. The Civil War history then becomes a little cherry on top that I get for my Green Eyes exploration.
Mmm, like how they give you candy at the dentist. Also, think about that one. Oh, man. Yeah, I think that's a great point. Oh, that was the kicker?
The timing was just so good.
So, folks, we know we went long on this. Thank you and apologies and condolences to our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant, for sticking with us as we I'm in a weird place too, Matt. We probably want to call it a day. We'll have Noel joining us for a future adventure very soon. And for everyone who's hearing this, we would love to hear stories from the ghost in your neck of the global woods, your local national park. Even if you don't think there's a ghost story there, go check it out and help us learn more about it, as well as your fellow conspiracy realists. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on X. You can check out our weird avant-garde social media videos that we're doing. And if you don't want to do any of that, if you don't sip those social meads, then why not just give us a telephone call?
Yes, our number is 1-833-STDWYTK. When you call in, give yourself a cool nickname, and you've got 3 minutes, say whatever you'd like. Just please let us know if we can use your name and message on the air. If you got more to say, or links, or attachments, why not instead shoot us an email?
We are conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.